This is an ABC podcast.
Psychedelics are having something of a moment right now. There's a lot of interest in the use of LSD and mushrooms and ayahuasca and other psychedelics for therapeutic purposes. There's growing evidence that they can be highly beneficial in the treatment of depression and post-traumatic stress. And there's a growing aura of respectability around the practice of microdosing, taking small amounts of psychedelics in order to promote everyday creativity and mental clarity and so on. In some ways, you could say that psychedelics and philosophy share a similar set of purposes. But does that mean that they're somehow related or even different expressions of the same impulse to know, to understand, to become wise? This is The Philosopher's Zone with me, David Rutledge, and this week we're talking psychedelics with Aidan Lyon, a philosopher at the University of Amsterdam and the author of a forthcoming book titled Psychedelic Experience. Aidan Lyon is speaking with Sam Barron.
There's something about these experiences that is philosophically fascinating. It's sort of like waking up from a trance that you didn't realize you were in, or escaping Plato's cave for the first time. And is often the case when you hit upon a good philosophical idea, it turns out that someone has already discovered it before you. In this case, the idea was discovered about 70 years ago by Aldous Huxley and Humphrey Osmond. Huxley was a famous author known for books such as Brave New World, and Humphrey Osmond was a psychiatrist working in the 50s, and was particularly interested in psychedelic-supported psychotherapy. So they were trying to come up with a name for the substances, substances at the time such as LSD, mescaline, psilocybin, and ayahuasca. And they were looking for a name that would capture the core feature of the experiences that these substances were inducing. At the time, these substances were often called hallucinogens, to signify that their primary effect is to create hallucinatory experiences. However, it was pretty obvious to anyone who had these experiences and was thinking carefully about them that hallucinations were only a superficial feature of the experience, and it isn't really what makes the experience so special for many people. So the question for Huxley and Osmond was twofold. What is the core feature of these experiences, and what is a good name for that feature? The general idea they settled on was that these experiences involve the inner depths of the mind coming up and appearing in conscious experience. And to name this idea, they used two words from ancient Greek, psyche and delos. There are different translations of psyche, and we can come back to them later on if you want, but a common one is simply mind. So, for example, psychology is the study of the mind. And the term delos means to reveal, or to make clear or visible, or to manifest. And so when we combine those two terms, we get psychedelic, which means mind-revealing or mind-manifesting. And so that means a psychedelic experience is a mind-revealing experience, an experience in which hidden parts or aspects of your mind are made clear and visible to you. Now, there's a kind of unfortunate and ironic twist to this history of the term psychedelic. So part of the reason why Huxley and Osmond bothered to create a new word was that they didn't want a term that was contaminated with prior conceptions or associations. They wanted people to think in a fresh and unbiased way about these substances in general, and in particular, this idea that they reveal the mind. However, as we all know, the 60s happened and these substances entered popular culture and got distorted by the media and politicized by politicians and government officials. So now the term psychedelic means all sorts of things. For example, it is often used to refer to anything that evokes that 1960s counterculture with its tie-dye t-shirts, psychedelic rock, and that sort of thing. And unfortunately, it's also used interchangeably with the term hallucinogenic, which of course is exactly contrary to what Huxley and Osmond were going for. They're trying to get away from this idea that the core feature of these experiences is that they create hallucinations. So now this is quite unfortunate. The term psychedelic originally had a carefully designed meaning, but we now have a conceptual mess on our hands. And so that can make having a clear conversation about this topic more challenging than it needs to be.
So what you've got then is a kind of notion that has these connotations to hallucinogens, to a kind of hippie counterculture in the 60s that was introduced originally almost as a technical term. And this presents like a really good opportunity for philosophy, it seems, because where you've got a kind of conceptual morass, in some sense, you've got a basis for doing good philosophy. So this sort of leads me to my next question. Why do you think we need a kind of philosophy of psychedelic experience in particular? What is that going to teach us? What are we going to get from that?
Yeah, I think so. There's several reasons why philosophy has a lot to offer here when it comes to psychedelic experience and the general topic of psychedelics. For one thing, the idea that we were just mentioning, that we can have these psychedelic experiences or mind-revealing experiences, as it was originally introduced, and if we don't say anything more about it, it's left as a fairly abstract idea. I think it was a profound insight about the effects of these drugs. As I said before, it's widely assumed to be true. However, without unpacking the idea in precise detail, it's not clear how we can go about testing it. If we just leave it at mind revelation, how can we know what would count as evidence for or against the hypothesis that these drugs are causing mind-revealing experiences? And what do mind-revealing experiences look like? For example, when we say some hidden part of or aspect of the mind is being revealed, are we talking something Freudian or Jungian? For instance, are we talking about the revelation of psychological complexes or archetypal images? Or are we talking about something more familiar to modern cognitive psychology, such as something pretty straightforward, like a memory from childhood that would otherwise be difficult to recall? So this is something that philosophers are good at, is unpacking an abstract idea. And I think that's what we need to do. We need to unpack all the ways that the mind can be revealed, what they look like, how we can measure them objectively. And then that can help us get a handle on that empirical question, whether these drugs actually cause these experiences.
I think that was one of the things that really struck me about your work when I was reading it, is that this sort of notion of a mind-opening or mind-revealing experience is much more everyday than just the kind of thing that happens when you maybe take psychedelic drugs. So, you know, you mentioned remembering something, but you've got some other examples of these sort of everyday kinds of experiences as well. Can you give me a couple of those?
Yeah, so this is something of a counterintuitive consequence of my view, but I think when you get used to it, it actually makes sense. So if you notice, in the definition of a psychedelic experience, we don't say anything about drugs. A psychedelic experience is a mind-revealing experience. There's no necessary connection to taking drugs to get those experiences. And one way of unpacking what a mind-revealing experience is that there's something hidden in your mind and it's being revealed. And all sorts of things in your mind could be hidden. So for example, a memory from childhood that you haven't remembered for a really long time. And most people have had the experience of, you know, walking along the street or just minding their own business, and then they encounter a smell, an aroma that they haven't come across since childhood. And that smell triggers a memory. There's a kind of flashback to that moment in childhood when you're around that smell. So you get this flooding of the memory into your conscious experience. And it looks like the reason why smell does this is because the olfactory senses have unusually direct connections to the hippocampus and amygdala that are associated with these memories. So I think these count as psychedelic experiences. Now, that seems counterintuitive because we obviously associate psychedelic experiences with psychedelic drugs. I think what's going on with psychedelic drugs is that they make experiences that are very psychedelic, and they make them happen much more frequently. So these experiences of getting flashbacks to childhood memories, they're pretty rare. They're not always happening, at least for most of us. But the thing is, when you consume a psychedelic substance, you reliably get experiences like that. And they're more psychedelic. They're kind of more revealing of the mind.
And so in the case of drugs, though, is it always the case that the drugs have the potential to clean up the signal and make them more mind-revealing? Or is it a more complicated relationship than that?
Yeah, it's more complicated. So once we're on board with this idea that experiences can vary in terms of how psychedelic they are, we can then think about what are the factors that make an experience more or less psychedelic. And it turns out there's some richness here that is useful to unpack. So to make things simple, let's move away from the mind for a moment and just move to the revelation of something else. So for example, we might be playing poker and I have a hand of cards that I'm hiding from you. Now, I could reveal my hand of cards completely by showing all of my cards, or I could just choose to reveal one of my cards. In that case, I've only partly revealed my hand of cards to you. I call this the scope of a revelation. So the object that's being revealed could be like more or less revealed. There's also the clarity of the revelation. So suppose I turned all of my cards over to show them to you, but at the same time, the lights go out. So it's very dim and it's hard for you to see the details of the cards. So the scope of the revelation is high because I've showed you all of my cards, but the clarity is low because you can't see the details. Or to take another example, instead of turning the lights down, suppose I've spilt some ketchup on one of the cards. And so I've got a seven of diamonds, but to you, it actually looks like the eight of diamonds. In a sense, I have revealed my hand to you, but it's been contaminated in the process. And so you're not quite seeing it as it truly is. And I think that might be happening during some of these psychedelic trips, that we're getting revelations of the mind, but they're not perfect revelations. Sometimes they're fragmentary, so we're only getting little bits of memories or what have you, beliefs, desires that are in the unconscious. And they also may be getting contaminated in that process of revelation. We may not be seeing things as they actually are.
Right. So we have this idea that the psychedelic experiences could be stronger or weaker, that they're coming in sort of different strengths, different degrees. And you've also said that with respect to psychedelic drugs, there could be some link between, you know, the strength of the psychedelic experience, like it might be really strong in the case of a psychedelic drug. Is it the case that the psychedelic drug will only alter the strength, or could it sort of alter the clarity as well? Could it maybe obscure the experiences? How does the relationship between the experiences and the drugs potentially work?
Yeah, so you might think that taking ever increasingly strong doses of psychedelics would cause experiences that are ever increasing in terms of how psychedelic they are. But that may not necessarily be the case. There may not be this linear relationship between dose level and how mind-revealing the experiences are. In fact, you could have a turning point. At some point, the dose becomes so high and the intensity of the experience becomes so strong that the experience becomes more chaotic and more contaminated with hallucinations and delusions. And so the revelatory aspect of the experience starts to go down. So you can have that overall effect where the mind might be getting concealed more than it's being revealed. But also you may have these kind of variations in the quality of the experience. So it could be that scope is being increased, so you're seeing more of the mind, but the clarity is going down. Or the opposite might be happening. So I think this is what's happening during meditative experiences, that you're getting these small revelatory experiences. So not much is being revealed on a typical meditative session, but the clarity is high. So whatever is being revealed, you are seeing it as it truly is.
So is it the case then that meditation is another way of having a kind of psychedelic experience?
Yeah, exactly. So if we've defined a psychedelic experience as a mind-revealing experience, then it's obviously not connected to drugs, but it can also be connected to other things. And I think meditation can be a way of having these experiences. Indeed, when you look at some forms of meditation, such as, say, Vipassana meditation, the translation for Vipassana, it's loosely translated as insight or special seeing. And so the idea behind a lot of meditative practices is that they involve like seeing the mind or having greater access to the mind. And a lot of the effects, although the practice of meditation looks quite different from the stereotypical image we have of someone taking psychedelics, when you look more closely at the psychological and phenomenological effects, there's a lot of similarities. So in both cases, you get insights. In both cases, you can get like memory flashbacks. You can get visual effects during meditation as well as psychedelics. And you can get substantial alterations to the perception of time. And most interestingly, I think both seem to cause what we might call like peak psychedelic experiences, sometimes known as mystical experiences, where very substantial alterations to consciousness occur. So things like the usual distinction that we have between subject and object, between the self and the world, that gets dissolved. And so you get this, you can have this sense of oneness or connection between what you normally took to be you and what you normally took to be the world. You don't have that boundary anymore. So it's quite striking that those experiences happen during meditation and psychedelics. So these two interventions or practices that look very different actually have a lot of similarities to them.
You're in the Philosopher's Zone, and this week Sam Barron is talking with Aidan Lyon from the University of Amsterdam about psychedelics and psychedelic experience. It's a subject that comes with a lot of 1960s counterculture baggage that can sometimes get in the way of understanding psychedelic experience. But as we're about to hear, philosophy can help.
Sort of can't help but ask a metaphysical question here about, you know, what might be getting revealed in those kinds of experiences. If the experience is supposed to be mind revealing and part of what's happening in that experience is this dissolution of the self, is there some, I don't know, hint that this might be giving us a kind of metaphysical access to the nature of reality somehow through experience in the way that some Buddhists suggest.
Yeah, that's certainly the kind of takeaway message that a lot of people have. So, but it's important to know that there is some variation here. So some people have these experiences and understand them as a revelation that there is no self, that our usual conception of the self is illusory. But then you can find the exact opposite view, which is that some sort of true self is being revealed in the experience. And the history of Buddhist and Indian philosophy, there have been these debates over whether or not there is no self or whether there is a true self. And if there is one, what is that nature? From my perspective, I try not to take a hard stand on these issues. I'm more interested in kind of working with the easier cases, like things like memories or perception or insights, and trying to figure out if we can kind of validate these experiences, checking to see if they really are mind-revealing. And if we can do that, then we can kind of slowly ramp up our ambition to these more extreme states where substantial changes to the perception of the self are occurring.
One of the other things I found fascinating about the discussion of psychedelic experiences in your book relates to the sort of flip side of psychedelic experience, what you call psychocryptic experience. Can you tell me what a psychocryptic experience is and why it's important to the way that you're thinking about psychedelics?
Yeah, so the term psychocryptic is a term I coined to capture the opposite idea of psychedelic. So if psychedelic means mind revealing, then the opposite idea would be mind concealing. And I took the Greek word kryptos, which means to conceal, as a name for this opposite concept. And like psychedelic experiences, I think psychocryptic experiences are super important. They happen all the time, but we're often not aware of them as a unified class of experience. So they happen when you get angry and do something that doesn't conform with your usual character. They happen when a clever salesperson spins you into a mindset and you buy something you don't actually want. You see this with the design of supermarkets, I think. And one of my favorite examples is when you need to pee. So if you hold it in for a really long time, it becomes difficult to think. You lose access to your mind in a frustrating way. Or here's another example that a lot of people are familiar with. It's called the tip of the tongue experience. So when you want to say a word, but you can't quite bring it to mind. You know the word. You just can't get it out. And you can even kind of feel the word, like what letter it begins with or how many syllables it has. It's right there, but it's just concealed enough so that you can't use it. Now, I think this idea of psychocryptic is really important because generally speaking, we want access to our minds. We want to be able to remember the things we've learned. We want to have access to our core values, our plans for the future, and so on. And for the most part, we don't want our decisions to be emotionally driven without our awareness. These things are simple, but it turns out they're hard to do. You see it all the time in business, for example, that companies' employees lose direction. They forget what they're really trying to do and why they're doing what they're doing. So in general, the more psychocryptic your mind is, the less freedom you have, the more you are bound by whatever container you're working in. And so we may seek psychedelic experiences to break out of these boxes that we find ourselves trapped in, to reveal this hidden stuff in our minds. But as so often the case, prevention is better than treatment. It would be better to avoid things being concealed in the first place. And this is where I think the Buddhist notion of mindfulness comes in and why it's such an incredibly important idea. It's also another misunderstood idea. So you often hear that mindfulness consists of paying non-judgmental attention to the present moment. There's something right about this definition, but it's kind of incomplete and it can be misleading. I think it's better to think of this definition of paying non-judgmental attention to the present moment as a way of practicing mindfulness rather than as a full account of mindfulness. So when we look at the kind of full concept of mindfulness, it involves a kind of psychological flexibility whereby you can call objects of the mind into awareness whenever you want, and you can see them as they truly are. This involves being able to pay non-judgmental attention to the present moment, but it can also involve critically evaluating a plan you have for the future, if that's something that you want to do. So one definition of mindfulness that I rather like is in terms of the mind being psychocryptic. The more mindful you are, the less psychocryptic your mental state is. That is, the less your mind is concealed from you. And I think this explains why mindfulness involves the ability to pay non-judgmental attention to the present moment. It's because we're so often trapped in ruminating about the past or worrying about the future. And because of that, most people find it very difficult to be fully present in the moment. We get trapped in these boxes about the past or about the future. And so if you get stuck on some personal conflict you recently had, It's difficult to pay attention to whatever it is that you're doing in the present moment. Psychedelic experiences can help you burst out of these traps, but mindfulness can help you from getting into them in the first place.
Okay, so a big part of your view and your interest in psychedelics actually revolves around wisdom. So for you, psychedelic experience and the investigation or having of psychedelic experiences or pursuit of psychedelic experiences might be a kind of road to wisdom or deeply connected to wisdom. Can you tell me a little bit about how wisdom plays into your understanding of psychedelic experiences?
Yeah. So first of all, we need to say a little something about what wisdom is, since philosophers have debated this for centuries and there are different conceptions out there. There's also a large and growing literature on the psychology of wisdom. So there's a rich history and huge literature that's difficult to do justice to. But I think a reasonable broad characterization of wisdom is that it involves knowing how to live a good life and actually living the best life that one possibly can. And the notion of good here is doing a lot of heavy lifting. It's commonly thought to capture a range of things, including avoiding suffering and perhaps attaining pleasure. But it also includes having meaningful and positive relationships, learning, conducting oneself ethically, making good decisions, acquiring knowledge concerning important topics such as mathematics, science, art, music, and so on. Maybe even being creative and flourishing in general, and also managing life's difficulties such as disease, the death of loved ones, and our own mortality. So a good life can mean different things for different people, but the idea is that it's some kind of mixture of these sorts of outcomes. So straight off the bat, we can notice that many of these outcomes of being wise are also outcomes of psychedelic trips when they're used appropriately and safely. People report living better lives, being more connected with others, being more ethical, more creative. They also report having important insights, ranging from issues in their own lives to professional problems that they're working on, to even metaphysical or spiritual or religious insights. There also appears to be a remarkable reduction in the fear of death. So one famous 2016 study from Johns Hopkins examined the study of psilocybin had on the depression and anxiety of terminal cancer patients. And they found a substantial reduction in anxiety and depression, even at a 6-month follow-up. What's interesting is it's not that the subjects turned from, say, atheists to theists believing in an afterlife and took consolation in that. But rather, there tends to be a newfound awareness of that we really don't know what happens when we die, and an acceptance that this is okay. So now to kind of connect more to wisdom, curiously, we see Socrates describing this point in his speech, in his famous speech that he gave at his trial. He's known for introducing this idea of a kind of human wisdom, which involves being aware of the limits of one's knowledge, of not thinking you know something when you really don't. He connects that idea with overconfidence in all sorts of domains of life, but at one point in his speech, he makes the point that this is why he didn't fear death. In contrast to others, he was aware that he didn't know what happens after death. And another notable similarity was that right before his execution, Socrates was giving comfort to his friends rather than the other way around. You might expect Socrates to have been upset and his friends consoling him, but it was the other way around. And interestingly, it seems we're getting this tendency coming out of the psychedelic studies as well. Those who are at the end of their life undergo such a grounding transformation that they're actually the ones giving consolation to their loved ones. This connection also appears to line up with Socrates' general conception of his human form of wisdom. You fail to be wise in this sense if you think you know things when you really don't. And there's a sense in which you already have the information you need in order to recognize such mistakes. If you just sat down and thought carefully and examined your beliefs and why you have them, you might be able to find some of these unjustified beliefs. But it can take a long time because there are all sorts of factors that blind us: our ego, our fears and insecurities, the habits of thought that we're not aware of, and so on. And so I think we have a role here for psychedelic methods in philosophy. Rather than relying exclusively on our conscious intellect to uncover these blind spots, we can take advantage of this mechanism of mind revelation. And you often see this in the reports coming from psychedelic trips and also meditative sessions. People come to realize that some of their most cherished beliefs are false, or at least the confidence that they have in those beliefs is not warranted, and they require further scrutiny. Now, the idea here is not that, you know, you can just drop acid at a music festival and suddenly you're going to become wise. But the connection here that I'm drawing is between psychedelic experiences and wisdom. It's not necessarily between psychedelic drugs and wisdom. So we need to make sure that we keep that distinction in mind. As far as the substances go, to the extent that they do produce psychedelic experiences, then they may be tools for helping us to become wise, but they're tools. And like all tools, they can easily be misused. So we need to be careful when we're thinking about this. It's not just simply a matter of taking a drug and becoming wise. You need some kind of structure around the experience and engaging with it in an appropriate way.
So you mentioned that philosophy itself could be a way of improving these sorts of mind-revealing experiences. So does it turn out that listening to the Philosopher's Zone turns out it is a sort of way of improving your mind revelation and psychedelic capacity?
Yeah. Well, so, I mean, philosophy helps us think clearly about anything in general. And I think that's especially important when it comes to these substances. I mean, they change how we think, right? And they cause such radical disruptions to how we think. And so you need some sort of framework for making sense of these. And because the changes are so dramatic and so varied, I think you need something fully general that can account for any kind of content or insight that's coming out of these experiences, and to be able to think about it critically and in a way that will allow you to integrate that insight into your experience. As far as I can tell, philosophy is the only thing that fits that bill. It's the only thing that has that kind of flexibility and generality while also being anchored in everything else that we care about, such as science. So it goes in two directions, actually. So I think philosophy is really useful for helping us understand our psychedelic experiences and make sense of them and navigate them in fruitful ways. But also it can go in the other direction. And so we were just talking about psychedelic experiences helping us with wisdom. I think they can also help us with the more kind of contemporary goals of philosophy as well. We often get stuck in our ways of thinking in philosophy. It can be difficult to like appreciate other people's perspectives. And I think these practices, whether they involve psychedelic substances or they involve meditation or something else like such as yoga, there's a new source of flexibility that they provide. They can make it easier for us to explore possibility space and to have like empathy towards others and to understand the perspectives that they're coming from. So I think it's kind of a powerful combination, actually. Analytic philosophy on the one hand and psychedelic experiences on the other.
So philosophy and psychedelics together at last, in some sense, both bringing us wisdom and using wisdom to make us into better philosophers.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Aidan Lyon, he's a philosopher at the University of Amsterdam. He's the author of a forthcoming book titled Psychedelic Experience, and he was talking there with Sam Barron. Check the website for more information. This is the Philosopher's Zone, and you can find us via the RN website. You can also follow us on whichever podcast app you happen to use, but if you're using the ABC Listen app, then that is your one-stop shop for all of our other fabulous ABC content. Thanks for your company this week. I'm David Rutledge on Twitter @DavidPZone, and I hope you can join me next time. Bye for now.